Hey, this is Scott Love, host of NALP Talk. Welcome to another episode. And today we're talking with Nikaya Gray, executive director for NALP. And we're talking about some of the issues that are top of mind for her that she wants to discuss. And Nikaya, it's great to see you again.
It's great to see you as well, Scott.
Wow, what a great conference in Florida.
Thank you. I thought it was so much fun. We had about 1,600 members on site. So it was a really fantastic event.
Wow, that's great. I know. I loved it. It was good to see old friends and make new ones, and everybody learned a lot there too. And plus, they had a good time.
Yes.
So today we're talking about some of the things that you're seeing in the legal industry. And I wanted to start off by asking about NALP's report on diversity in U.S. law firms, which was released in March. And I know you had some concerns about that report. So tell us what you saw in the data this year, Nikaya.
Yeah, so there were several notable findings this year. First, that fragile pipeline of racially diverse talent that we first spoke about in the 2024 report does appear to be weakening. Across all levels, the representation of diverse lawyers either stagnated or decreased, but it was particularly profound at the summer associate level, where that representation dropped by 5.5 percentage points, which is really concerning. That's a large drop. Now, the representation of students of color in those summer associate classes is still a few points higher than their representation in the recent law school classes. So under ordinary circumstances, I would not be too surprised to see this shift. But of course, these are not ordinary circumstances we're talking about. This is happening against a backdrop of the administration's strong anti-DEI policies, which have, of course, caused some firms to move away from their diversity commitments. So I think any drop in representation right now is a cause for concern. It should give us some pause. And that's doubly true when we're talking about those summer associates, because as those programs are the entry point into most firms, any significant changes in the demographics of that group is an indication of how all of these shifting policies are going to play out in those firms. And that brings me to our second notable finding. Far, far fewer law firms provided data this year compared to last year. Now, it's important to know with all of this that the data set for this report is drawn from the demographic data that law firms provide through their listing in the NALP directory of legal employers. In this reporting cycle, 230 fewer law offices provided demographic data as part of their profiles compared to last year, which represents the loss of data for roughly 47 firms and 31,000 lawyers. That's highly concerning to me. It directly impacts our visibility into the legal profession at a time when there are many, many things that are impacting who has access to law schools and who ultimately has access to these jobs. So it's critically important that we continue to have the data to produce that diversity report.
So let me ask you, Nikaya, is the diversity report in jeopardy?
Yeah, great question, Scott. So at a high level, no, or I should say at least not yet. I mean, look, NALP will produce some level of diversity report so long as we have the data to do so, even if it's only high-level reporting. I think it's that important that we do so. What's in jeopardy is our ability to disaggregate the data in ways that allow firms to benchmark themselves against peer groups, as well as allows all of us to understand the differences in the market, whether that be by firm size, geographic area, cohort, or by any other factor we track. If we saw another drop in the data like we did this year, we may not be able to do some more of that deeper reporting that we currently do.
Yeah, that is concerning. What do you think is behind the drop in reporting?
Yeah, that's another great question. So in this moment of intense anti-DEI backlash, demographic data has really come under scrutiny. And because of that, organizations are very wary of collecting the information and publicly disclosing it. As I mentioned earlier, the data for the diversity report comes from listings in the NALP directory, and those listings are public. Anyone can create an account and then see those listings. That's the purpose of the directory, right? It's a tool for job seekers, particularly those students, to learn about different employers. But in this moment, of course, some firms are concerned that if they publicly share that information, they may become a target. And that concern is resulting in that drop in reporting that we're seeing.
Right. So what is NALP going to do about this, Nikaya?
Yeah, so this year, we were already planning to move the renewal period for the NALP directory to early fall to better align with the new recruiting timeline. So the next renewal period will be in September. When we make that change, we will also make it possible for firms, when they are updating their listings, to provide demographic data directly to NALP without having that information included in their public profile. So that will be a new option this year. I do want to say, though, that even though we're providing that option, I still encourage every firm to include demographic data in their profiles, as that information is just so, so important to students when they're thinking about where they want to work. But for those firms who don't feel like they can do that, this change will allow them to still participate in NALPS research, which is ultimately so critical.
Yeah, that's great. I hope that helps. And let's switch gears now a little and talk about some of the things that you're watching in the legal industry right now that you think NALP members ought to know about. What is on your mind these days, Nikaya?
Oh gosh, Steve, there's so much happening right now. Since we were just talking about diversity, let's stay on that theme for a second. I've talked before on this podcast about my concern that the Supreme Court's affirmative action decision was going to have this cascade effect, right? Where we see not just only fewer students of color going to law school, but also where they're going to law school shifting, and specifically shifting away from the most selective schools to less selective schools. And that shift could amplify those employment disparities that NALP has long documented for graduates of color. In the May Bulletin, Danielle Taylor and I published an article giving a bit of a preview of two academic papers that NALP will publish later this year with Kyle Rozema, who is this incredible professor from Northwestern Law School with an economics background, and who was the lead author on an earlier paper about how state-level affirmative action bans impacted law school enrollment. In our papers, we're going to be able to quantify how those bans impacted employment outcomes, which gives us some insight into what we may see once the impacts of the Supreme Court's decision plays out. And spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't read the article, it's not good. It's really not good. In these first two papers, we're looking specifically at what we call highly remunerative pipeline positions, which we've defined as being either federal clerkships or law firms positions paying at least the 25th percentile of the prevailing big law salary each year. So those top paying law firm jobs. And what we found is that after the state bans went into effect, the number of underrepresented minority graduates obtaining those pipeline positions declined by 68% at the highly selective schools and 41% at all other schools. And the impact, as you might guess, was most severe for Black graduates, with the number of Black graduates obtaining those pipeline positions falling 84%. Compared to 48% for other underrepresented minority graduates. So these are really, really disturbing results. And they suggest that the Supreme Court's decision could dramatically reduce access to these jobs for many, many graduates.
Yeah, that is disturbing. Did your research give any indication as to why affirmative action bans impacted these positions so severely compared to other jobs in the legal industry?
Yes, it did. So again, these papers were specifically looking at those federal clerkships and those top-paying law firm jobs. And what we found was that the market share for those positions is highly concentrated. There are 19 schools which produce, on average, only 16% of law school graduates, but they filled 53% of these positions, so a little more than half of those positions. And that's more than the combined market share of the remaining 186 law schools that were included in the study. So law school pedigree strongly shapes who has access to these positions. But when affirmative action bans are enacted, we see that cascade effect I mentioned earlier that shifts where underrepresented minority graduates go to school. And for some of those students, shift them to schools that command less of that market share of those positions, which in turn then impacts our access to the positions. And all of this, you know, has me highly concerned about what we might see now that there is effectively a national ban on affirmative action.
Yeah, is there anything you think NALP members can do?
Yes, there absolutely is. So we can all address the role that pedigree plays in hiring decisions. I mean, look, Justice Clarence Thomas, who, by the way, is one of the big conservative judges on the court and sided with the majority in the Supreme Court's affirmative action decision, once publicly criticized this bias against graduates of lower-ranked law schools as being comparable to discrimination against women and minorities. And he's right about that. There are incredible lawyers graduating from all of our law schools. The fact is, where somebody goes to law school is just as much, if not more, dependent on factors like tuition, financial aid, you know, proximity to family, school culture, all of these factors that have nothing to do with ability. In fact, you know, now that the new federal loan student loan caps that go into effect in July, that cost, the cost is likely to become a primary determinant of where somebody goes to law school, if they're able to go at all. So it's really, really imperative that employers who still want to see the best talent address any biases they have in the hiring process around law school pedigree. It's going to help them maintain a robust pipeline and ensure that their positions are accessible to candidates of all backgrounds, not just candidates of color.
Right. And you mentioned the federal student loan caps. I imagine that's one of the issues you're watching right now. How do you think these caps are going to impact law students?
Yeah, so it's definitely going to impact them. So to make sure our listeners are all on the same page with me here, currently law students can borrow up to $20,500 per year or $138,000 in aggregate in federal direct unsubsidized loans. They can then finance the rest of their cost of their school with Grad PLUS loans. Starting in July 1st, law students will be able to borrow up to $50,000 annually, but there will be a lifetime cap of $200,000 in the aggregate, which is going to include any federal loans they took out for their undergraduate education. Additionally, and this is where this is the really big change here, Grad PLUS loans are going away. They're no longer going to be available to make up that difference. For law students, these caps are going to be particularly challenging. I mean, currently, the average annual tuition and fees at a private law school exceeds $50,000. And of course, students have living expenses on top of that. You know, one analysis I've seen suggests that more than a third of law students currently borrow over that $200,000 lifetime cap. So the net effect of all of this is that many students will either be forced to choose between either limiting where they go to school based on cost or seeking out private loans. And of course, that's if they don't forgo law school altogether. And many students, it's important to recognize that many students are not going to qualify for these private loans, either because they don't have good enough credit scores or simply because they're younger and they don't have any credit history yet. You know, and theoretically, cosigners would be an option, but for many students, they're just not accessible. And so it's anticipated that all of this is going to disproportionately impact the most vulnerable population, students of color, first-generation college students, parents, veterans, right? All of whom are currently more likely to rely on that financial aid than their peers and less likely to qualify for private loans. So the student loan caps are really going to limit access to law school and what school students have access to. And of course, that all means it could also limit who has access to certain jobs because of that role pedigree plays in hiring that I was talking about earlier. So it's really critical on a number of fronts that we address that elitism around law school pedigree. I truly believe that employers who want to ensure that they are seeing top talent and that they have a pipeline that includes, you know, students of color, first-gen students, veterans, parents, all the groups that we've been talking about, they're going to need to address this. They're going to need to consider talent from a broad range of schools.
That's really concerning. Are schools doing anything to help close the funding gap, Nikaya?
It is concerning. But yes, schools are trying to help in a variety of different ways. Just recently, I saw that the University of Kansas and Washington University in St. Louis announced lending programs for the students who have exhausted their federal student loan options and who may not qualify for those private loans, which is fantastic. Other schools are entering preferred lender agreements in which, you know, the lender partners with the school to provide loans to students. Also, our colleagues over at Access Lex have created a suite of resources to help, including a private loan exchange. So there's definitely lots going on in this space, and it's promising. But this is still something all of us need to be watching closely, as even with all of this, the loan caps are likely to disproportionately impact students of color, those first-gen students, parents, and veterans.
Right. So we've been talking about the pipeline. What else are you watching?
Yeah. So one of the most interesting things that I'm watching right now is how talent models are shifting at these larger law firms. And there's this excellent industry report called the Citi Hildebrandt Client Advisory that everyone in the industry should read. I highly recommend it. It comes out every December. And it's one of the two main industry reports that I rely on when I'm developing my opinions. The other, if you're curious, is that Thomson Reuters State of the Legal Market. But the Citi Hildebrandt report tracks many of the key metrics at law firms, and one of which is leverage, right? Which is that ratio of non-equity timekeepers to equity partners. And it's a key metric for firms as it directly correlates to that ever-important profits per partner, right? And so what they have found in their report is that leverage has increased for the past 5 years straight, but has also shifted towards a more senior talent model. So specifically, the growth in that leverage model is at the of counsel and income partner levels, not at the associate levels. And that trend is expected to continue over the next 2 years. And that's what's really important about this is that while the vast majority of the firms who responded said they do plan to increase their overall associate headcount, only a third are saying that they plan to increase their summer associate and first-year headcounts. So this tells us that these firms are planning to adjust their associate populations over the next 2 years to a more senior demographic by focusing the majority of their hiring efforts at the upper associate levels, which is a major shift in the market, and it has a lot of implication for upcoming law school classes. So it's something I'm watching closely.
Do you think generative AI is going to impact any of that?
Yes, I do. So, you know, one of the questions asked in the Citi Hildebrandt study was whether firms thought that they would make further changes to their leverage models as a result of Gen AI. And firms were much, much more confident this year in saying, yes, it would. Specifically, we saw 25% of the firms saying that Gen AI would impact their leverage models in the next 2 years. And that number increased to 63% when the firms looked out 10 years. And specifically, they expected that Gen AI was going to accelerate the shift to an even more senior leverage model, where they're replacing some of their junior associates with more senior talent who can do that work that Gen AI can't. So it's one of the reasons I think that Gen AI is going to impact talent models. The other reason is that there is this real tension right now between the need that firms have to raise rates to cover the rising costs related to things like the substantial investment they're making in technology, this shift towards a more senior leverage model, which costs them more. You know, there's a tension between that and growing client resistance to these rising costs. So the Thomson Reuters report that I mentioned detailed that buyer sentiment among corporate legal departments is really deteriorating, and that there is a high likelihood that clients will continue to move sophisticated work in-house, which Thomson Reuters says could cause demand to decrease by mid-2026 as the market, you know, starts to normalize or soften. So firms' pricing power is really constrained. There's a limit to how much they can raise their rates without losing clients. And when I think about those facts and the fact that the traditional value proposition for a junior lawyer is closely linked to high billable hours on tasks that are increasingly susceptible to being replaced by Gen AI, it suggests that junior attorneys have significant exposure and that law firms are going to be increasingly selective around entry-level hiring, as well as, you know, who they keep on once they've hired.
So how do you think that's going to impact new graduates?
Yeah, so all of this suggests that large law firms are moving away from talent models that are so heavily reliant on junior associates. And, you know, we'll probably see this behavior develop in more mid-sized and small firms over time as Gen AI gets embedded in those firms as well. So this all means to me that firms will likely be hiring fewer new graduates in the near future. And that's something for our NELT members at schools to be keeping in mind as class size is starting to increase again. The classes of 27 and 28 are going to be large classes, similar to what we saw with the class of 24. But they're not going to have that advantage that the class of 24 had in that their recruiting cycle overlapped with that post-pandemic period we've been calling the talent wars, which then propped up their job figures, right? The market has really shifted also in business and public interest in 2024. So a lot has changed since then. So the class of 27 and 28 may need some additional attention as they're going to be facing a different job market than the class of 24 did. I should say, though, that I'm still optimistic that they're going to do well. They just may need a little more help getting there.
Right, right. And we've been talking about the entry-level market. Do you have thoughts on the lateral market, Nikaya?
Yeah, so the lateral market is expected to remain hot even as the entry-level market cools off. Demand growth, as I mentioned earlier, is modest, and there's even some predictions that it could decline by mid-year. So when that happens, firms tend to be more likely to focus on pursuing market share through lateral acquisition, particularly those income and equity partners, which means we'll probably see significant lateral movement that's focused on higher value practices, more sophisticated practices, and higher value clients. In terms of geographic growth, the U.S. is expected to remain the main target for law firm investment, with New York being the most important market in the U.S. for investment. London, however, is firmly positioned as the number two market in the world for growth, which is a great lead-in for me to plug that NALP is now in the U.K. too. On September 29th, we will be hosting our third annual NALP U.K. Summit. So for our listeners who have responsibilities for the U.K. market or who have colleagues who do, this is definitely something they want to have on their calendar. We'll be sending more information out about that soon, but mark September 29th on your calendars now.
That's great. That's good to know. Thank you for sharing your insights today, Nakaya. It's always good to hear your perspective. And we'll talk again on the next episode of NELP Talk.
Thanks, Scott. It's been a pleasure.